Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Riding the Storm Out. My good friend and co-pastor Dan Fisher is here, and he is going to be like that dummy mannequin because he is still smitten. He's still smitten with laryngitis. But this week, and of course, my name is Paul Blair. We work together here at Fairview Baptist Church, and every week we bring you a biblical response to some of the current cultural issues. And of course, the biggest issue that we've all faced here in America over the last 2 years is this climate crisis and how it's being dealt with in the public by the by the so-called professionals. And I don't know about you, but I have learned to not trust the professionals every time they talk anymore.
Fauci is science.
Yeah, Dr. I forgot about that. How dare me? You know, I could probably get the death penalty for doubting the inerrant word of Dr. Fauci.
I'm going to turn you in.
Well, one of the subjects that everybody's been questioning is masks. Are masks efficacious? Do they really work in spread and stopping the spread of the virus?
Well, if yours goes up to here.
And if it's made out of plastic, if you put a plastic bag mask over here, it works beautifully. Well, this week, again, we've got two blessed research scientists that we have become friends with that have taken it upon themselves to actually go through all of the studies from around the world. Doesn't matter whether it's from America or Sweden or the Danish studies or the Australian studies. They've looked and analyzed all of them and compiled the data. So this week, we're going to get a well-researched, well-documented report on the use of masks.
When an individual passes of COVID-19, basically what happens is there's an international coding and a national database of coding that exists. We use, in the United States, U07.1. That information was published by the CDC, and you can look in this highlighted there. So COVID-19 deaths are those that are confirmed in language, again, or presumed COVID-19, and they're coded with a U07.1 code. Again, that's not of. And if you read this quote here, in cases where a definitive diagnosis of COVID-19 cannot be made, but it's suspected or likely that circumstances are compelling with a reasonable degree of certainty, it's acceptable to report COVID-19 on the death certificate as probable or presumed. In these instances, certifiers should use their best clinical judgment to determine if a COVID-19 infection was likely. And why does that matter? Well, if you allow people subjectively to just say it was presumed or probable, there is a chance that they might give you inaccurate information. If you also add a 20% upcharge that goes to the hospitals through our Medicare and Medicaid services, which equates to about 59% of the American population, you also get into a scenario where there's financial ties to reporting it as a COVID-19 death. In March of this year, FEMA also, I think, added that there are funeral expenses given to families, which again, I would support as long as the scientific data supported that they passed from COVID-19, where they were given $9,000 for each family member that would have passed for help with burial services, etc., up to $35,500. That information is in the law. You can read it and go find it. Now, what's different about the U07.1 versus the U07.2 is the World Health Organization actually changes that documentation, and they require a U07.2 coding if you cannot conclusively or provide testing to support that COVID-19 was the cause of death. That's an important data point that you want to tease out the information, because what can happen is you can have a heightened reporting of COVID-19 deaths, which, if we look at California, which in June of this year, June 6th of 2021, they did a soft audit of all their COVID-19 deaths, and what they found in just two counties there is that their deaths were reduced by 25% when they actually went back and looked at it, and there were people dying from car accidents, or they were in a homicide scenario. Well, when you pull those out, that matters. Well, again, why I put the infection fatality rate there. If your COVID-19 death rate is reported, it's put on all of our television screens continuously for us to look at, to constantly evaluate the risk associated with us leaving our homes, going to church, going to schools, going out and living a quote-unquote normal life. And there's an impact that basically a majority of those could be fraudulent it changes your numerator and denominator in both of those equations because, number one, the test that you use to confirm whether a COVID infection exists matters, and number two, the coding that you use to determine the death could have just been presumable or, you know, well, we think they had COVID. Now, I'm not saying a lot of people do that. I don't know. But I'd say it would probably be appropriate if we required seroprevalence testing or a blood test to confirm the presence of the virus in the system and or a PCR test if run at appropriate threshold cycles. And that may not have sounded like English, and I will explain what threshold cycles are and what the PCR test is because, again, all of this is interconnected. But it's important to understand that this is how the coding goes. There is a 20% upcharge that goes to the hospitals for reporting of COVID deaths. There is a fund that provides access to American citizens whose loved ones pass of COVID-19 for funeral expenses, et cetera. So more details about that can certainly be found in one of our chapters that's already online there if you want to indulge in reading some of that this evening. So this one is probably what really piqued my interest. When you're in an administrative role, you're constantly looking at safety for individuals and people that you care for. And so I had been watching this very closely since March of 2020 when we first went on lockdowns. Most of our schools, most of our businesses shut down for, I think it was 15 days to stop the spread, correct? We're now 2 years in and we're still not stopping the spread, which is kind of depressing. But maybe we can shift that narrative. And so the question I always have about tools or instruments that we use, it's like, okay, who came up with this idea and who invented it? What was their credentials? What was the mindset behind its use? Why is it important? And so Dr. Kerry Mullis actually was the inventor of the PCR test. It's a polymerase chain reaction test. He won the Nobel Prize for this in chemistry in 1993. He was actually a pretty eclectic individual, so if you want to read about him, he has some pretty fascinating history. But what does this test actually do? And that's of critical importance, and so I'll try to explain. Basically, the test itself, if you go in for a PCR, what happens is the DNA sample's taken, they swab, right, a nasal swab up your nose, everybody loves how comfortable that is. You take that out, imagine a ladder, right, and so a ladder has rungs. You heat up your DNA, it splits that ladder, right, so now you have two. In this process, you add a primer to it, and that starts to build out the bottom rungs of the ladder. And then you add the polymerase to it, and that replicates your DNA the rest of the way up the ladder and tells you, imagine your body being everything, the entire Earth. There's lots of microorganisms, lots of things you've been in contact with. As that builds out, that tells you what your system has come in contact with over time. Now, it cycles through. That's your cycle threshold, so it cycles through. The setting that you set that cycle threshold at matters tremendously to the reliability and validity of the test. And so, as I'll show you, anything run above a 35 actually will give you, I think, about 1,000 billion data points of DNA, which that gives you some perspective of how much information that is. The problem with that is, using that as an analytic tool is fine. Using that as a diagnostic is not okay. And Dr. Mullis actually discussed that in a lot of his research. Why? Well, many of you have been exposed to coronaviruses in your life. You may have had flu. You may have other DNA fragment particles that exist. The minute individual small fragment that might exist within your system does not mean that you are infectious. It might mean that you've come in contact with it over some point in time. And the higher you spin that threshold cycle, the more robust data you're going to get, which then is difficult to use as a reliable tool to say, okay, you have COVID-19. Especially if that test is only sequenced for a specific variant of COVID-19. And so, ironically, on January 22nd of 2007, we'll go back to the New York Times, there was a piece written there, Faith in Quick Tests Leads to an Epidemic That Wasn't. And this was actually at Dartmouth Hospital in that area. And basically what happened was they had a whooping cough outbreak. So they had a physician there that they thought had whooping cough. And what they did was they brought in a PCR test. They tested 1,000 of the hospital workers because they were concerned about that spreading. It's a serious virus. And what they found was 142 of them tested positive. So they quarantined all of those workers. They isolated people. They brought in other hospital care workers from other places to help cover during that time. And then 8 weeks later, after they got back blood tests, they found out that nobody had whooping cough. That was pretty upsetting, right? And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And so then you ask the question of, okay, what did they spin the cycle thresholds out, right? The cycle thresholds at. And the New York Times has actually come out and said, basically anything above that 35 is not replicant competent. And so I will show you that. This was on July 17th of 2021, where Dr. Fauci actually says, if you have a cycle threshold of 35 or more, the chances of it being replicant competent are minuscule, meaning if you test it again, you're probably not going to get the same result. And we have plenty of evidence of that. I know we're in Oklahoma and everybody loves football, but I played soccer in college. And so Cristiano Ronaldo was going to play one of the most important soccer matches for those that follow it. And he tested positive 3 times for COVID through PCR tests. Now, he used different language than I would choose. Up in that top corner, and we definitely kept that small for a reason. But you could see the frustration there. There are actual clinical studies out of different nations where individuals may be in a hospital setting, and they can take as many as 4 tests, and they'll get a positive, and then a negative, then a positive, and then a negative. And it's like, again, what are we spinning it at? What is the cycle? And how are we using that as a tool to help us combat COVID-19 is very important. So that all, you know, kind of piqued my interest. And then, interestingly, on January 7th of 2021, COVID-19 cutoff values. So our own CDC released publicly that we were changing nationwide the threshold cycles. So you have to understand that when labs are agreeing to this or states are agreeing to it, they give the labs the setting of which they have to run the cycle thresholds at, right? And so what happened basically at that point in time is they dropped them from above the 40s into the 30s. And so here I am, like, I got to figure this out, right? And say, okay. So I go to Quest Diagnostics, which is a company that does PCR tests, and I read in their actual manuals, basically running a PCR test above a 40 would give you at least a tremendous amount of false positives, and so they should just be calculated as a negative test. And then you go to LabCorp, and they say the same thing, and then you start looking at what other states were doing. If you want, and I'm sure this link will be shared, you can have proof of adjustment to the cycle thresholds in Kansas, where actually they dropped it from 42 to 35. Now, the dates matter, because on January 7th, 2021 is when they drop it, and you can see our cases that happen in the United States, and they drop. And what did they correlate that with? The rollout.
Pineapple.
Which is a little concerning. Now, ironically, the 35 cycle threshold, again, we know that that's not replicant competent. In April and May of that same time period, they actually started to run vaccinated at a different level than unvaccinated. And so they dropped it to 28 cycle thresholds if you were vaccinated, and if you were unvaccinated, they were running it at the same that they were doing for the states. And why would you do that? Because then you can't report breakthrough infections, which continues a narrative that's actually really tragic. And so that data is from Johns Hopkins University. I think it's interesting to look at that point in time and then look at what happened. And then you can see we still spiked again, which we'll get into that a little more detail later. If you want to watch that video of Dr. Fauci, you're more than welcome to, so please check that out. Now, I will say that the state of Oklahoma, and this is confirmation from October 20th of 2021, the information is blanked out so that nobody gets in trouble, but we're still running our cycle threshold values at 37 in the state, which is a little concerning. And then in July of 2021, the CDC came out and basically recalled the use of the PCR effective on December 31st of 2021. And they openly actually admitted, how many had the flu last year? Yeah, so they admitted within this document that the PCR test basically, they didn't have a multiplex measure. They were only looking for the SARS-CoV-2 variant in existence there, and you couldn't differentiate whether it was flu or that actually going on. And so again, from a data standpoint, those specifics matter tremendously. And so that's a little bit of the background on the PCR testing. Again, we continue to use that. Many of you have probably heard that it's referred to as the gold standard. I think I referred to it as gilded copper alloy. I'm not sure if it's a gold standard for much. I will say that I don't want to discredit the fact that it is a great analytical tool, but to me it should be used as a piece of information that our clinicians and our doctors and nurses actually take and say, okay, you're showing symptoms of the virus, that it's there. We're going to run this PCR test at a 24 to 28 cycle threshold. That should give us a pretty good accurate assumption of how much of a viral load exists in your body. If it's spiking and you're getting consistent tests, maybe we could probably assume. And then later on, we're going to do some seroprevalence testing because you're probably going to have some antibodies that exist. And then we know that you were actually infected with the virus, which then would give you confirmation that you could use a U07.1 death coding if the individual passed away. But again, if we're using the PCR test as the variable to U07.1 and they're spun at a 37 where you know you will get exponential false positives, even if you apply that test to the death coding, there's problems there in the data. And so it's not that simple of an issue, but it's one that all of us need to be thinking about and wrapping our heads around as we go in, as employers are requiring testing, as you know, we are constantly using that as a gauge of which we create public policy. And Dr. Carrie Mullis actually passed away in, I think, August of 2019. And I do believe there's a lot of interesting data there, but I do believe it's interesting. He actually tried to debate Dr. Fauci in 2003 at the University of South Carolina and had some pretty select words about his thoughts of him as a scientist. And I don't know, I never met either of those individuals, but I find it fascinating that the individual that invented the PCR test has openly said to us that we should not use this as a diagnostic, but that it is appropriate to use as an analytical tool to get a little bit better of an understanding about what is within our body. So, masking the science and disastrous public health policies. Okay, so masks. Interestingly, we were just talking on the way up, and so we're coming from south in the state, and we had a little bit of a drive, but I was reading in the state of California, they had a lot of historical documentation of the 1918 flu that had occurred in California, and they actually had a section on masks. They were wearing gauze masks at the time, and it was very interesting, so I should include it, and when we write that, we have a chapter on it, and we're going to have to edit that to add this information, but basically, the Department of Health in California at the time, the individuals that were working there, they looked at masking, because in San Francisco, basically, they required masks for any citizen that was sick, and if you wouldn't wear it in public, they would actually arrest you. And what they found was they compared San Francisco's death rates to Buffalo, Washington, D.C., and what was the other, I don't know what the other city was, Buffalo, Washington, D.C., and basically when they looked at it, they found that the mask had no effect. And they published this information, and they said as much as we wanted them to have an effect, they weren't preventing, and they weren't effective as a measure to prevent
pineapple.
And the science behind that is actually quite valid. So interestingly, in May of 2020, which is right as we started to enter into the pandemic, you had a meta study on influenza and looking at flu viruses. And so if you look at the micron or the particle size of flu, it's about 0.8 to 0.12. COVID-19's 0.125. So a little bit bigger in particle size than your flu virus. But this meta-analysis or meta-study, and I will explain that. So a meta-analysis basically is you take all of the studies that you can find on flu and mask, you throw those all together, you look at the data from them, and then you produce a larger population size of which you can make hopefully better public policy from because you have a lot more data to make that decision. So our own CDC basically found that face masks had no effect, neither as personal protective equipment nor as a source. And that was 14 randomized control trials. So anybody that's in the scientific field knows that randomized control trials tend to be the most scientific and gold standard within them that we want to use. If we look nationwide, though, basically, One of the studies that I think is key, and the database continues to grow, but it has about 12 million participants, was out of Brown University, and they were comparing New York, Florida, Massachusetts, all these different states, and in all of those analyses, the rates were similar for staff in districts that had mask mandates for those students and staff versus those with staff-only mandates, and they did not see a correlation between mask mandates and COVID-19 rates among students, either in their adjusted or unadjusted. So that's a 12 million population group there that they're using. That's pretty conclusive information about the efficacy or the value of wearing a mask in public and if they work. New York Magazine actually noted this year, and it's ironic because, you know, I don't love to look across the pond for ideas. I tend to like if the United States is doing the best. But basically, countries, so Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, UK, etc., they haven't even permitted individuals to be in masks, and they haven't had mask mandates. And if you look actually at the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, which differs tremendously from the United States, they actually said any child under the age of 12 is not permitted to wear masks. They've had that in place basically September of this year, where the United States, through August, we had that come back up again, and then we masked everybody back up after our summer was pretty free with kids going everywhere. So it just hasn't had the effect. We have 48 peer-reviewed research studies. If you would love to spend the time reading those on mask efficacy, that is also published online, so you can check those out. But it's important just to give you some context behind their value. And we should probably point out the football stadium there, where most Saturdays we see nobody in them anymore, and we're not seeing the crazy cases among those populations. So these are, I think, important graphs. So Yanon Weiss is a individual that puts these together, and if you don't know him, I would encourage you to follow some of his work. But basically, just looking at comparisons, so North Dakota and South Dakota, North Dakota had masks and business restrictions. South Dakota didn't have masks or business restrictions. And you can look at their trend of cases of COVID and the effect of it, right? And they correlate pretty well together. You can also look at the United States, the European Union, and Sweden. One country, Sweden, not having any mandates, not doing lockdowns. They have the lowest ICU capacity in all of Europe, and their cases were lower than the United States and the European Union, which did mask initially. And then a lot of individuals ask questions, okay, but what about an N95 mask? And so if you look at Bavaria in Germany, basically they put into place a N95 mask mandate, and you can see again how it basically correlated and had no effect on the actual outcome of wearing them in public. And then if you compare Germany and Sweden, you can see Germany's medical mask mandate, and then they still have the spikes that occur. It's not really having that impact. So the value in them, again, it does not bother me if individuals want to wear a mask. I think that that's their choice. But I think if we're looking at children or if we're looking at workplace practices and policies, we should look at the science behind that. And there are studies out there that may conflict with this, but I think the overall majority of them, if you're looking at it as a whole, I think it's pretty clear that they do not have an effect on stopping the spread. Now, one of the important things that I like to point out is some of the effects that actually are occurring. And so, especially in kids and mental health issues that we're seeing, and it's like, well, you know, where do they go? So, I'm going to read a few of those statistics, but one would be the obesity in children. And so since the start of the pandemic, we've had basically a 17% increase in weight gain among children, you know, 0 to 17. Those that have higher body mass index are actually seeing higher gains. We know that from a health perspective, that has a tremendous impact on their bodies long term. And so when you lock down populations and they're at home watching, you know, TV or on screens all day and they're eating junk food and just trying to get through the moment, there are adverse effects to that. Same with the mental health issues. So one that I would say that's pretty disturbing is I think we've had a 50% increase in suicide rates of girls ages 12 to 17. since the start of this, and nobody's really having that conversation. If we want to talk about adults, the Lancet study that recently came out, and this is a lovely way to look at it from the graph, before the pandemic and during it, that looks at global prevalence of depression and anxiety. So we have 54 million people now with depression and 73 million people now with anxiety. And if you start to think about who makes out when you have more people that are depressed and have anxiety, it starts to go back to similar companies because there's medications to help support those things. ER visits for suicide attempts among teenage girls rose. And one of the important, there's a still face experiment that was done out of the University of, out of Massachusetts. And so Tronick was the PhD who studied that. And basically, what is the still face? Well, I mean, it'd be really cool for me to do, but if I just stood here and looked at you all with a still face consistently, had no facial expressions, eventually it's going to drive you crazy. You're probably going to leave the room. Why does that matter with masks? Well, when you block the communication mediums that we use and you don't see the expression that's there, there is tremendous data that exists about the impact of that on trust and on relationship building. And so when we start talking about our children, and now that we're 2 years in to this situation, and many of them are still wearing masks and are scared, have fears about COVID that continue to exist and manifest themselves, it has a psychological impact that is very often swept under the rug and not being discussed. And more data, I think, is coming out about that daily that we all should be paying attention to. Oh, you get to go now.
Hi, everybody. All right, so I'm going to jump in right here, how to mitigate the pandemic. So we have lots of documentation back to 1918. This paper was published in 2006 that says how to mitigate a pandemic. Thoughts from 2006, this is about the flu. They said in this document that travel bans don't work. They said social distancing and school closures don't work. But what did we do? We did it anyway. And you know, I think that there's some leaders in the room, and one of the things about being a good leader is you can admit when you were wrong. And Governor Ron DeSantis, one of my favorite governors, said he just came out today and said, I supported President Trump in the travel bans in January 2020, but you know what? They didn't work. So I'm not going to do that again. And we're going to look to all these early treatment protocols that I'll talk about, and we're going to get everyone back in the game without the masking and the mandates and the travel bans. And I think that we need to hold our leaders accountable in Oklahoma and make sure that we, the people, make them follow the science to keep us safe instead of what they're following now. And so, this whole thing became so political, and no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, you really have to seek the truth. And sometimes your ideology, the truth doesn't follow, that the ideology. You have to always seek the truth. And so President Biden, well, before he was president, came out and, called President Trump a racist for inciting these travel bans. Well, what did he just do November 26th? There's another travel ban. No one can travel to and from Africa. It's too late. It's already, once you institute a travel ban, the virus is all over anyway. So it's too late. They do nothing. And I think all they do is cause economic hardships, social hardships. And so we have to really pay attention to what social policies we put into place. And it has to follow the science, not the political whim of whoever's in office. That's really important.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Riding the Storm Out, and we look forward to being with you next time. Until then, well, you still can't say anything. Until then, we'll see you next time. God bless you.